Today's Teisho is on case 7 in the Book of Serenity. Case 7 is entitled Yao Shan Ascends the Seat. Introduction. Ears, eyes, nose, tongue. Each has one ability. The eyebrows are above. Warriors, farmers, crafters, merchants, each returns to a job. The unskilled one is always at leisure. How does a real Zen master devise techniques? Case. Yang Shan hadn't ascended the seat to lecture for a long time. The temple superintendent, the Karmadana, said to him, "Everybody's been wanting instruction for a long time. Please, Master, expound the teaching for the congregation." Yao Shan had him ring the bell. When the congregation had gathered, Yao Shan ascended the seat. After a while, he got right back down from the seat and returned to his room. The superintendent followed after him and asked, "A while ago, you agreed to expound the teaching for the congregation. Why didn't you utter a single word?" Yao Shan said, "For scriptures, there are teachers of scripture. For the treatises, there are teachers of treatises. How can you question this old monk?" Verse. A foolish child troubles over money used to stop crying. A good steed chases the wind, looking back at the shadow of the whip. Clouds sweep the eternal sky, nesting in the moon, the crane. The cold clarity, it gets into his bones. He can't go to sleep. Thank you so much for your excellent practice this morning. All of you are really sitting deeply. It's wonderful to see that kind of practice. It's just inspiring to be in the same room with people who are sitting so beautifully. And of course, when people come into Dogasan, it's clear as well that everybody's practicing really deeply. Wonderfully. On the people attending online are doing a wonderful job, really, really wonderful job. This process takes a lot of courage. Right? It takes a lot of courage to do this. It's easy not to understand how much, I think. This is a story about a Zen teacher who has not given a talk in a long time. And his student, the Karmadana of the temple, comes to him and says, "Roshi, you really haven't been giving anybody an instruction." And he says, "Okay, I'll give a talk." And everybody assembles in the Dharma Hall to hear the Teisho. And he gets up on the platform and sits quietly and then goes back to his room. And the Karmadana, the temple superintendent, comes and says, "Well, I thought you said you were going to give a talk, right? I thought you were going to give a presentation." And he basically says, "I'm not a scholar, and I don't lecture on treatises. I'm trying to show people the great way." Right. And this is there's a history of Zen, a history of Zen in China, called the transmission of the lamp. It's the transmission of the lamp. It's this Chinese classic, and it's full of stories about how Buddhism starts with the Buddha, and then it goes on to Mahakashapa, and each of the characters gets a little section, and there's a story about how the student met the teacher, and then the student's insight, and there's a poem, an enlightenment poem, and then the teacher meets the next student, and then you go to the next person, and you have a little bit of the student's encounter with the previous teacher, and it's this braided narratives, and in one of the stories it talks about Nagarjuna, who's very important for our tradition. Nagarjuna was really the person who talked about emptiness, really. You know, Nagarjuna was a Buddhist philosopher and great meditation master. And he lived at a time when people were, there were intense debates in the Buddhist community. And also the Buddhist community had these intense debates with other communities. So Buddhism wasn't the only game in town in India. There were rival philosophies. And there was, you know, they would have debates that were, public debates. People could come and hear a Buddhist philosopher debate with an Indian idealist philosopher or an Indian materialist philosopher. And these debates were, very important. They had a big impact on people's lives. In India, they really took these debates seriously. It's like if you were a leader of a Buddhist community and you were debating with, say, a Hindu teacher, if you lost, your temple had to turn into a Hindu temple. Really, that actually happened, right? It's like, okay, you're all Hindus now. You lost the debate. It sounds crazy, but that was actually true, you know. So basically, or if you lost the debate, you know, the king might just seize your property, your temple's properties, and throw everybody out on the street. So they took these ideas really, really seriously, and that was sort of at the extreme end. But there was, you know, there was this feeling in at the time that Buddhism was under attack, you could say, and it was, you know, from different quarters. And Buddhists, you know, felt like they really had to have the best possible ways of responding to criticism, right? And sometimes they won these debates and sometimes they lost, you know. And I think we may not call ourselves Buddhists, but we live in a world where, ideas are really consequential, right? I mean, it's consequential. You know, so there are people who say, I'm not political. You say, I'm not political. And, you know, if you don't vote, you know, that's a vote. Right? I mean, if you don't vote, that has a consequence. You might not like the candidates, but if you don't vote, that's like voting, right? It has a consequence. And if you're going to vote, you probably would do well to study study the facts. So in my town, Plainfield, we have the city government is not very well run. And, you know, we have these elections, these off-cycle elections, and, you know, people sneak into office, you know. So it's really important to sort of investigate the candidates and turn out to vote even though it's this weird, it's like a, you know, a weird day. So there is something to be said for being to being on top of these details. Right now we're facing all kinds of, we've been through really a bad period politically, right? Lots of chaos and frightening developments politically. And if you read, if you're sort of a news junkie as I am, you read the newspaper and so on, or you read online, and you feel, sometimes you just feel this tremendous sense of paralysis and urgency. And, you know, you may also, you know, find yourself like walking around, going to the supermarket, having arguments with people in your head. And, you know, it's possibly the case that other people are doing the same thing. You know, they're all walking around the supermarket having arguments in their head. You know, this is like the human world, right? You know, we live in a world of ideas, we live in a world of, you know, and ideas have real consequences. The interesting thing is, though, that the more we live in this world of contesting ideas, you know, the more trapped we can feel. I don't know if you've had this sensation, but you know, if you look at something like the climate, global climate change, right? You know, it's like it's such a big problem, right? And it's so hard, you know, that every day it seems like there's another report that's frightening, and you think to yourself, why aren't we moving more quickly? Why aren't we, you know, shifting to electric vehicles right away? You can just feel this sense of paralysis. And it's interesting, you know, the more you study, you know, one of the reasons I think people stop studying these issues is because the more you study them, the more complicated they become and the more paralyzed you feel. I don't know if you've had this this particular problem, but it can be, relationships can be like this, right? So my brother and I, my brother's deceased now, but my brother and I were like very different people. From the time we were little kids, we were really different. And we suffered a lot because of our differences. You know, we didn't always get along as little kids. We actually used to fight, like physical fights. And when we got older, we realized that we didn't want to beat each other up anymore, that we did love each other. But it was so hard to communicate, you know. And I don't know if you've ever had a situation where, you know, you can be with somebody for a couple days, and even though you start with the best of intentions, you know, it's just like you bump into each other, or you push each other's buttons. You know, I don't know if you've ever had that situation. Sometimes a relationship, like romantic relationships or marriages, can be like this, right? It's like you marry somebody and you think, you know, I want to live with this person for the rest of my life. And you think, you know, actually, you know, sometimes when you fall in love, you know, you literally don't want to be away from the person you love. You literally think, oh my God, I've got to go to work. I hate to go to work just because I'm going to be away from the person I love. And you know, when you're away from them, you're missing them, and you're back with them, and it's like wonderful. You know, and you can flash forward, you know, 30 years, and you know, I think anybody who's been in a relationship has had moments in their relationship where they're lying in bed thinking, you know, how can I go forward with this relationship? You know, it seems like if I go right, I'm wrong, and if I go left, I'm wrong, you know, and if I stand up for myself, I feel like I'm bullying the other person, and if I don't stand up for myself, I feel like I'm being bullied. And you know, and I mean, I myself have been in a long-term relationship, you know, and I've had times like that. I've had times where I, you know, wake up at night with like just feeling like claustrophobia. It's like, oh my God, you know, how did this happen, right? How did this happen, and how do we get out of this, right? How do we get out of this? And this can happen in like any setting, like a job, right? It's like my sister is a nurse practitioner, and her specialty is like, like oncology, right? So she works with people who, many of whom are not going to make it, right? You know, she often does, you know, works with terminal patients. She's like a super wonderful person. And, you know, she was in charge of her division for a long time, you know. But she finally had to quit. And my sister loved being a nurse. You know, it was something she wanted to do. She went to college and didn't go to nursing school, but she discovered this profession and she fell in love with it. And she became really good at it, right? And she became a nurse, and then she became a nurse practitioner, and she just loved it. And you know, she didn't volunteer to work in this oncology ward because she wanted an easy dollar. You know, she really wanted to do well, right? And to be of help. And she really wants to be of help to people. And she's very caring, right? And she, you know, this is a kind of job that can eat you up, but she did it for like a longest time, like 25 years or something. And she finally quit, she said, because she said, they kept adding more and more people to our shift. You know, I finally felt like I was going to make a mistake, that I couldn't take care of that many patients. And their hospital had been bought by some larger, you know, conglomerate, and they were upping the ratio, nurse-patient ratio. And she said, I felt badly every day I went into work. So these are like examples of how, you know, we can get trapped, right? We can get trapped. You know, it's definitely the case that you can take a job that you love, and you can find yourself 25 years later not wanting to go in to work. And when you lie in bed at night and you think about, you see no way forward, right? It's like, if you move this way, checkmate. If you move this way, checkmate. If you move this way, checkmate. Your job can be like that. Relationships can be like that, right? Where, you know, you start out with the highest. I think nobody gets married or enters a relationship thinking, divorce, here I come, you know. But it happens to, you know, 60% of people. And when it happens, before it happens, you know, you lie there and you think, what is going to happen? You know, what am I going to do? I have a friend of mine who's a younger person than I am, and he spent 5 years writing a book, and he's having a hard time placing his book. You know, he's an academic, so he wrote this book. He spent 5 years, he those were days he could have been going at the beach, you know, he's working at his word processor, reading, writing. And, he writes this book and he sends it off to the press he thought was going to love it, and they didn't love it. And it, you know, so it's like trapped, right? It's like you look here, you're trapped. You look there, you're trapped, you know, and so on. I don't know if you've had this experience. If you haven't, I'm so happy for you. but most of us have had this experience, right? In our lives, right? And my friend, you know, he felt totally trapped. It's like, if I don't, you know, I've spent 5 years on this, you know, and I've given put my heart and soul in this, and I can't find a press to pick this book up. Or, you know, I loved my job, but they're giving me too many patients. Or, you know, we lie in bed at night, or we're sitting, you know, in our rooms, and we're ruminating, and it just seems like there's no, you take this, it's closed. You take this, it's closed. You take this, it's closed, right? And I think this is kind of what the koan is getting at, right? It's like people maybe came to hear this Zen master, you know, because they wanted him to tell them something, you know, that would be useful to them, right? So if somebody came to hear the Zen master and they were having trouble in their relationship, you know, they wanted the Zen master to say, okay, well, you know, tell me about your relationship. And then the master would say, well, you know, you need to listen more. You need to practice listening, you know, and then you could go away from the Zen master and you could practice listening. You could say, oh, I was going to say something, but I'll just listen, you know. And maybe it would work, you know, and it would be so helpful. You could come back to the Zen teacher and say, thank you, you told me about listening. What a great secret that is. And the teacher here doesn't do that, you know. Maybe one of the persons in the audience is a nurse practitioner, and her company is giving her too many patients, and she's waiting for the teacher to say, okay, you know, here's how I handle having too many Zen students, you know. I do it like this. And the person could listen and say, you know, that's a great idea. I'm going to try that, you know, and maybe go back to the hospital and do this, this, and this, and everything's running smoothly. See, so, you know, these are all, you know, if only the Zen teacher would do these things, you know, maybe you're a philosopher and you have to debate with a Brahmin intellectuals tomorrow, and if you don't, they'll seize your temple and turn it into a Brahmin temple instead of a Buddhist temple, right? So maybe you could go to the Zen master and say, quick, give me some good arguments. I don't know what to say, you know. So you know, I've told this story before, but, you know, a woman who had just opened a store came to sit with us at the university. And she was practicing Zen. She just started practicing, and she said, you know, afterward we talked, and she said, I'm opening a store, and I'm very stressed, and will meditating help me to be successful in my, in running a store? And she was waiting for me to say, oh yes, you know, if you meditate, you're sure to do well. And I couldn't say that, you know, I couldn't say that. And, you know, I actually said something that she never came back, of course, so. But I said, you know, that, like, you know, if you read the literature, most businesses fail, right? I mean, most businesses, like, you know, 60% of businesses, new businesses fail, right? So in the retail sector. Small businesses, right? And I said, so maybe if you don't think so much about success and failure, it might be easier for you to go forward, right? She wanted me to give her, like, if I say, well, okay, well, when you feel stressed, do this, you know, when you feel stressed, sit down and just breathe, you know, breathe. And I hope she found, she probably found somebody who told her to do that, right? And that's good, right? I'm happy that she found such a person, but you know, there was a bigger issue at stake, I think, in this, you know? This is the one that's the hardest one. This really happened. There's a woman who teaches at Rutgers. She is Korean, and her family was probably Buddhist at some point, but like many Koreans, after the Korean War, she became interested in evangelical Christianity. She got disenchanted with evangelical Christianity, just stopped being interested in anything except her work. She and her husband had a son who was this wonderful person, you know. He went to some Ivy League school and he was, you know, very promising, and he was going to go into the nonprofit sector, you know. And he was on a bike ride in like Washington State, I think. And it was a charity, one of these charity bike rides where you ride, you know, 150 miles in a day for charity. And he got killed on the interstate, right? I mean, he was killed on the highway, and the person who killed him has a history of drunken driving, right? This is a truth. This really happened. And so after you know, deliberating, she called somebody from the evangelical church, and they came and talked to her, and she wasn't satisfied. So she came and she asked me to come, because she had come and sat with us when we used to sit in Princeton sometime. And she said, "So, what can you say to console me, you know?" And I said, "There's probably, you know," I said, "this is never going to feel better, you know." And I said, I very much doubt this will ever feel better." And she said, "Well, is my son going to be reborn?" And I said, "I don't know." I said, "You know, that's some Buddhists believe that when you die, you're reincarnated, you know, but I don't know. I really don't know. I've never recalled a past life." So I said, "It's a big question mark, right?" And, she wanted me to tell her something that would make this go away. But of course, there's nothing, you could say, "Oh, he's in heaven he's in a better place." You know, that's so dishonest, right? So anyway, I would be doing her a disservice if I had said he's in heaven just to make her feel better, right? So this, the teacher is trying to show people something. Nagarjuna was trying to do the same thing. You know, Nagarjuna, this philosopher I talked about a little earlier, you know, you had all of these people arguing, and they lay awake at night and said, "You know, if I take this route, he's got me. If I take this route, he's got me." And Nagarjuna said, look, none of this is real. None of this is real. You know, none of the things we believe are real. And he really was a brilliant philosopher. And he showed how if there is a self, you know, he looked at our concept of self. And he said, "So, you know, if the self is real, what is it about the self that's real, right? Because you're probably not the same person you were when you were five. You're a very different person now, and would you be the same? Would I be Kurt if my father Larry hadn't been my father, but Bill had been my father? You know, and it's very very easy to show how the concept of like Kurt is really not very substantial. It starts falling apart if you begin to probe it a little bit." And people, some people hate this, right? You know, but actually, you know, Nagarjuna would do this in arguments. He'd pick people's arguments apart and leave them nothing to hold on to. And some people just hated this, but a lot of people realize, you know, I feel better. You know, I feel better now. There's a, in this collection of Chinese stories I talked about, it says, it's very similar to this koan. It says that Nagarjuna was giving a talk, and he gave a talk to this big audience that came to hear him speak. And there was an enlightened person in the room, and when the enlightened person looked up, he could see that it wasn't Nagarjuna sitting at the front of the room, it was like the sun blazing in the sky, or like the moon, like a full white moon. And this enlightened person looked up and saw the full white moon, but everybody else just saw this fat little guy at the front of the room talking. And the story is saying they weren't ready to understand what Nagarjuna had to say. See, and it's probably the case that in this story too, you know, the master is trying to say something to the students, but they may not be ready to understand what he's trying to communicate. You know, if you've come looking for an answer, like a solution, right, you're actually not going to find the solution, right? You're not going to find, because the problem is, the solution is never the solution you think it is, right? And the solution comes from stepping out of the whole game that you're playing with yourself, right? When you begin to realize that these things that seem so important are not important, and that seems so impossible sometimes, right? But when you suddenly step back and you say, it's all empty, there's nothing behind any of this, suddenly, you know, you're set free. And it seemed like every door was closed, but when you step out of the game like that, you realize there's all these things you can do, right? There's all these things you can do. You know, it's a little bit. Yesterday I was comparing this to I was talking about therapy and Zen, and it's very similar in some ways to therapy again, right? I mean, people often go to a therapist thinking that the therapist is going to give them some advice, right? So one time in my relationship with my wife, we were having a very bad time and we didn't know how to solve our problems. So we went to this really wonderful relationship therapist who was really like wonderful. And for a long time, neither of us were happy with the experience, you know, because he wasn't giving us any strategies, right, for dealing with our relationship. You know, we wanted him to give us some tips or some pointers, and he didn't do that. You know, that was actually a wonderful thing. You know, a good therapist doesn't tell you what to do, you know. I don't know if you've been, there's a show on television now, I think it's called Shrinking. It's about a therapist who becomes depressed and his life is falling apart, and he goes into therapy one day and he starts telling his clients what to do, his patients. So there's this woman who's in this terrible relationship and she won't leave, and he finally says, "Don't you see, your husband's using you, leave him." You know, she does, and she turns out to be very happy. She took his advice, and he's very happy. You know, so there's a number of these cases where he violates this rule in therapy or counseling, and tells people, "Here's how to solve your problem. Do it," and they do it. You know, it doesn't always work out, though, right? And it's funny, but actually, it's like a bad idea, right? Because you're taking away something from people, then, right? You're taking away their power. And their greatest power is the ability to step outside of all of this and enter emptiness. And when you enter emptiness, you see that you're freer than you ever dreamed possible. You know, so So the teacher in this case could just tell people, you know, be a good person, you know, turn the other cheek, etc., etc., you know, don't eat any meat, you know, don't do this, don't do that, you know. And Buddhism has elements of that, of course, you know, but the teacher wants to give them something more valuable than that, this, right? He's giving them like the gift of emptiness, right? So that they come for a talk and there's no talk. And you know, you can imagine a range of responses, right? The people might say, well, you know, I paid for a talk, damn it, you know? Or somebody might say, you call yourself a Roshi? And you call yourself, I mean, I've had people say things like that to me. You call yourself a teacher, you know? I came to you for answers, you know? It's like, okay. So that's you're doing them a huge injury, right? You're doing, you know, businesses fail. What are you gonna do if your business fails? And you think, oh, I can't, I will have to commit suicide. Well, that's not a good strategy, right? I mean, if you look at the history of people, you know, who have had good lives, they're littered with failures, right? Littered with failures. You know, people, when they fail, they, you know, if they're not too, if they're able to let go of their failure, if you're able to let go, people cling to their failure, right? That's the problem. We cling to our defeats and we cling to our failures. You know, if you let go of your failure, you just start out, you just keep going, right? You just keep going. You know, I you probably know this story, but, you know, Stephen King is one of the most successful writers in the United States. And when he got, I don't know how he developed this kind of personality, but he really wanted to be a writer. And when he got started, he would write these stories and send them out and books. And he said that like his wall was covered with rejection notices, right? He'd just take a rejection notice, paste it to the wall, and get back to work. And he did learn, he didn't ignore the rejection notices. You know, he thought them over. But he didn't let that stop him. He didn't let that stop him. And you know, for some reason, his psychology or his personality was such that he was able to sort of say, this doesn't matter. This doesn't matter. And even if you think about things that are really important, right? Sometimes even the most important things are it's better to have a this doesn't matter attitude, right? You know, my brother and I had this relationship that was very fraught, you know, but toward the end of his life, he died a long time ago, but we got along much better because I think we just stopped trying to break through the ice, and we just were with each other. You know, we would just be together, and we weren't like trying to get somewhere in our relationship. And I remember, my brother and his wife and he had one son at the time, and. You know, we all just went out to took his kid out to the zoo in Washington, D.C. and had dinner. And you know, we are totally different people, right? I mean, I trembled to think that my brother would have voted for Trump, but I'm sure he would have. It's that kind of... But, you know, we had a wonderful day, you know, just being with no expectations for or against anything, right? And it was a little bit like that with my father. You know, my father was more like my brother, you know. And, you know, toward the end of his life, you know, he was dying of any way of cancer. And it was just like, I'm not trying to get your approval. I just want to be present to be helpful to you. You know, what you think of me doesn't matter. You know, I really meant it. It's, what do you think? It's too late for what he thinks of me to matter. How can I be helpful here, right? How can I help? And I think I was really helpful. I think I really did. I don't know what he thought of me at the end, but who cares, you know? I was there, and I had no expectations. I didn't think he was going to lean over and go, you know, you're a good son after all. And he didn't do that, you know. But, you know, basically things went so much more smoothly when I said, what happens next doesn't matter. I just need to present myself and be helpful, or I just need to be kind, right? So this koan is really about the power of you know, nothing matters. You know, the power of emptiness, right? That, you know, we all get, every day of our lives we get trapped in some kind of mental trap, large or small. And we think there's no way out. If this doesn't happen, it's the end of everything, right? And that's an extension of how we, you know, that's an extension of thinking itself, right? Thinking itself closes all these doors. So when we sit down on the cushion and practice mushin, you know, we're learning how to free ourselves from really anything, any obstacle. And koans are really obstacles, right? I mean, a teacher ties you up in knots and you get out, right? Eyes, ears, nose, and tongue, each has one ability. The eyebrows are above. Warriors, farmers, crafters, merchants, each returns to a job, right? The unskilled one is always at leisure. See, so you have a skill. Maybe you're a nurse, maybe you're a mathematician, you know. But you also have this, there's also an unskilled one inside you, right? With no skills, right? The person with no knowledge, no skills. and this is the person who can set you free. Right? How does a real Chan Zen master devise techniques? Yao Shan hadn't ascended the seat to lecture for a long time. The temple superintendent said to him, "Everybody's been wanting instruction for a long time. Please, Master, expound the teaching for the congregation." Yao Shang had him ring the bell. When the congregation had gathered, he ascended the seat. After a while, he got right back down from the seat and returned to the room. So he... And in the commentary, it says, you know, one of the masters commenting on this in the collection says, what an incredible display of supernatural power. See, it was a display of supernatural power. And it is. It is. Okay. Okay. The superintendent didn't get it, though. It's like Nagarjuna speaking. Enlightened people look up at him speaking and they see the brilliant, clear moon of a winter night, right? Enlightened, the Dharmakaya itself. But other people just see a dumpy little guy droning on. The superintendent followed after him and asked, "A while ago you agreed to expound the teaching. Why didn't you utter a single word?" Yao Shan said, "For scriptures, there are teachers of scriptures. For treatises, there are masters of treatises. But what about this old monk? How can you say that to this old monk?" "A foolish child troubled over money used to stop crying." So in this is a a cliche in Chinese culture, to stop a child from crying, you give him paper money, like, you know, like the paper money you would give to like a ghost ancestor at a funeral, right? You give the kid some, and the kid sees this shiny money and stops crying. You know, if you say to somebody whose child has died, oh, he's in heaven, you know, you're actually just giving him, you're giving her paper money to stop her crying. But it's not really liberating, right? A good steed chases the wind, looking back at the shadow of the whip. Clouds sweep the eternal sky, nesting in the moon, the crane. The cold clarity gets into his bones. He can't go to sleep. So remember, cold is a symbol of wisdom, right? So, you know, gradually, when you dwell in emptiness, that liberating, cold, in the West, we say cold is like, you're a cold person. That's cold, like an insult. But if you think about ancient India, you know, it's so hot all the time. So coldness and cool, it's like you're down, it's 100 degrees in New Jersey, it's 105% humidity, and you see a picture of Mount Everest covered in snow, and you think, oh, yes, cold, right? So cold is like freedom, right? Freedom. The freedom of emptiness. So let's cultivate that emptiness, or continue, because you're doing such a wonderful job.